This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Yesterday, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf outlined his $33.3 billion budget for the next fiscal year. It included some of the same package of tax and spending increases that derailed his last budget that has still not been approved. He warned legislators that they were ignoring a ticking time bomb and should find another job if they didn't take their responsibilities more seriously. That did not go over well with Republican leaders. Meanwhile, the Senate is voting today on whether to oust Attorney General Kathleen Kane, who lost her law license. We asked Angela Columbus to join us. She's a writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer covering Pennsylvania state government. And Angela, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it seems the governor is not backing down. How did his words and even his tone, how did that play in Harrisburg yesterday?
Not well. I mean, his tone was really kind of the talk of the town after his budget address, primarily because it was not conciliatory in any fashion, and he employed lots of fighting words to try and drive home the point that the state needs to raise new revenue. There's a looming budget deficit, and he wants to be able to address that while at the same time also raising new funds for public schools, which under the previous administration had suffered some pretty severe cuts. But in getting his message across, I mean, he didn't mince any words. He basically told them, look, if you can't work with me either, agreeing to the budget agreement that we're coming back to the budget agreement that we had agreed to last year, or if you can't bring me something different that is acceptable, then you all need to basically find a new job.
Ouch.
And Republican leaders came out of that chamber. I mean, they were pretty red-faced, and you know, one of them called it absurd, and another called it outrageous, and the rhetoric started afresh. And it has been, for those who may not know this, Pennsylvania still doesn't have budget for this fiscal year.
Angela, from your reporting and people that you've talked to in Harrisburg, are there any taxes? Because this is so much a part of Governor Wolf's budget, which is increasing a whole host of taxes, which we can talk about. But are there any tax increases that a Republican or a Republican majority in Harrisburg would support?
We don't know really the answer to that question, because last year, even when we had a tentative agreement, at least between Senate Republicans and the administration, the agreement really was on the spending, and they very religiously steered clear of saying this is the actual tax that we would support in order to raise the money to support that spending. I think that if you talk to some, both Republican and Democratic senators, they tend to say that they prefer to do an increase in the personal income tax rather than the sales tax, which they see as sort of a regressive tax, and it would hurt poor families, middle-class families more. But there has been no commitment, no stated commitment from either the House Republicans or the Senate Republicans on a specific tax.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Angela Columbus. She's a writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, has been covering Pennsylvania state government. And again, we're talking about the governor's budget for the next fiscal year, just announced yesterday. And we will be talking about Attorney General Kathleen Kane. And if you want to join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And Angela, just picking up on what you said, so what the governor's new budget includes is an 11% increase in the income tax,
right,
and a sales tax on things like cable television, movie tickets, things like that.
Yeah.
You're saying that Republicans maybe would support an increase in the income tax rate?
It's possible. I think that if you talk to some Republicans, they will tell you that it's the lesser of two evils, if you're looking at that versus the sales tax. But they, like I said, they have not publicly, at least, and as a caucus as a whole, come out and said this is an actual tax increase that we can support, that we can get behind. I mean, they have religiously steered clear from giving, a yes or no answer to that question.
He also called for an increase in the severance tax to 6.5%. Now, that didn't go anywhere last time. Is there something that the governor knows that none of us know about that would indicate why he included this?
I think what his thinking may be is that he sort of sees this now as a two-year budget. He doesn't have a complete budget for this fiscal year, which ends in July, and obviously he needs one for the next fiscal year. So I think the way he sees it is if we can agree at least on a tax increase, it can apply to both situations. We can start raising money now. And we can have less of a fight going into finding an agreement for next year if we can agree that at least we need more revenue now. I think that is his thinking, and I also think that he's kind of waiting them out, because if what happened this fiscal year is that he has partially vetoed the budget,
right.
Which means that funds for public schools, he only released 6 months' worth. Well, in a couple of weeks, maybe even less so for some districts, schools are going to basically come back to Harrisburg and say, look, we need more money. We can't remain open without more funding. And I think that's going to become a really big pressure point in negotiations.
So is this way we're going to be doing budgets in Pennsylvania for a while?
Piecemeal? Yeah. Well, you know, it has dominated the conversation up here, I think to the detriment of other issues. And you have heard some legislators grumble about that they can't get traction on other issues because this is such a pressing, all-consuming problem up here, which is trying to get an agreement on a budget.
And it seems what the Republicans are saying, broadly speaking, is looking at doing pensions differently and also
right.
privatizing the sale of liquor in the Commonwealth.
Right.
I mean, that's been on the table for some time now, including during Corbett's administration.
Right.
Is there any movement, any traction on this? Is this a card that can be played in this what seems like game of chicken?
I think so. The governor, didn't really talk about those issues at any length in his budget address yesterday, that is pensions and liquor. And I think that's precisely because they become some carrots that he can hold out when they finally return to, serious negotiations on trying to get a budget done. But the Republicans have been pretty clear. They're not, at least on the Senate side, they're not going to agree to new increased revenue and increased spending unless they can get some sort of fix for the skyrocketing cost mm-hmm. of public employee pensions.
The governor also talked about the growing budget deficit approaching, $2 billion. Does that play in Harrisburg as a concern?
It is a concern, and I think the fundamental disagreement is, how do you address that? Governor Wolf's position has very steadily been that you have to have a recurring source of revenue, and that's big enough that it can start, really closing down that deficit. And you can only raise that kind of significant cash through something like an increase in the personal income tax or an increase or an expansion of the sales tax. Mm-hmm. And I think the Republicans have been more of the thinking of, well, you don't have to take those types of drastic measures which hurt middle-class families. You can do other things. You can find other ways to raise revenue. I mean, there's been talk about online gaming. There's been talk about other ways to raise money, even, increasing taxes on cigarettes, things like that, various other smaller sources of funding that you can use and collectively reach the number, that magic number to close the deficit.
Angela, we have a couple of minutes before we have to say goodbye to you. A big vote in the Senate in Harrisburg
yes.
today having to do with whether or not to remove Kathleen Kane, the Attorney General, from office.
Right.
What gives, I mean, and interestingly, she has said, look, if you want to get rid of me, impeach me, right, which is a very different process.
Right.
How did this end up in the Senate?
It's really a very dramatic moment for her today, and I think it's a really significant vote for her. But what has happened is that the Senate has looked to the Constitution, which talks about how to remove public officials, and it talks about impeachment, but it also talks about removing a public official for cause. And that's pretty much it, that the Senate, upon a two-thirds vote, can remove a public official for cause. The resolution, I should say, has to go to the governor, and he makes the final decision on the removal process. But it's a provision in the Constitution that hasn't been used in more than 100 years.
Oh.
And there has been some talk about whether it has afforded her the appropriate due process, and whether she has had really the ability to defend herself. And the question, and I'll say this very quickly, but the question that they have been looking at is, unlike impeachment, which talks about impeaching a public official for misbehavior in office, what the Senate is looking at is something very specific, and that is her law license is temporarily suspended at the moment, and it was suspended by the Supreme Court last year after she was criminally charged. And can she continue to run this office, which is essentially a law office, without having the ability to practice law? So there were a series of hearings last year that looked at that very question, and that is what they're going to be deciding today.
And she actually appealed to the Supreme Court this month, I believe,
mm-hmm.
And they voted 5-0 to really uphold their decision, but they said that she filed her appeal too late. So they didn't actually rule on
right.
the issue itself. It was really more on procedure.
That's right. I mean, they didn't really rule on the substance of her appeal, which was also when it decided to suspend her law license last year, that one of the justices who voted to suspend had a conflict. And that was that he was involved in this email scandal that has been ongoing now for, close to a year and a half, which was, emails having been exchanged, either offensive or pornographic, emails having been exchanged between judges and prosecutors and defense lawyers. But like you said, the court, in rejecting her appeal, did not take that issue up on its face.
And Angela, do we know when her trial is, or when that will go before the courts?
Yes, it is scheduled now for August 8th in Montgomery County, which is where the criminal charges were filed.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today and getting us up to speed on what's been happening in Harrisburg. Angela Columbus, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, covering Pennsylvania state government. And do stay with us. We'll be talking about Groucho Marx after this very short break. We'll be right back.
And here's that sterling Elgin American, the one, the only...
Groucho!
What a ridiculous name.
Oh, that's me, Groucho Marx.
I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Groucho Marx spent the majority of his life entertaining audiences and, it could be said, invented modern comedy along the way. Just as his star was rising, films were moving from the silent era to talkies, ripe for Groucho's machine-gun-like delivery of puns and put-downs. But his uncanny wit and goofy-looking experience could be described, according to our guest, as a defense mechanism for a frustrated, angry, and self-loathing man, making his humor complicated. Cultural critic and author Lee Siegel has just published a thorough and engaging analysis of Groucho's life, mind, and humor called Groucho Marx, The Comedy of Existence. Siegel is the author of 5 books and writes about culture and politics for the New York Times and for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with Radio Times producer John Ahrens recently about his take on Groucho Marx.
So with much analysis already out there of Groucho, of the Marx Brothers, what provoked you to add your voice to the canon?
Well, I noticed, and I've always noticed, especially when I began looking into him, that there really wasn't any critical literature about Groucho. He became a beloved icon. And when you become an icon, somehow you're drained of all the gifts and energies and originality that turned you into an icon in the first place. So people talked about him as a kind of cuddly, beloved figure, but all the bite and tension and darkness in him that made him who he was had been forgotten.
And one of the terms that is often used to describe Groucho in the Marx Brothers films is anarchic, and you take umbrage with this idea. Why?
Well, it's just a generic term. It's damning with faint praise. What comedian isn't anarchic, really? Comedy is anarchic. Laughter is anarchic. And when people say that they're anarchic, they give it a kind of positive spin. But I think these people, the Marx Brothers, were thoroughgoing nihilists. They didn't believe in anything, and they tore down everything. And they're not always funny. There's something going on beyond humor. I don't think anarchic even begins to characterize them.
But what about, you know, sort of their common scenario is that they're placed among these sort of prestigious and wealthy people, and they serve to tear them down. You don't see any social commentary in that?
No, they tore everyone down. In Duck Soup, which is touted as this great satire on war, they humiliate and abuse a hapless, innocent lemonade vendor who's done nothing to deserve their abuse. And in the end, Harpo cuckolds the man in his own bed, and Harpo emerges bold and glowing with vitality. There's no morality. There's no moral framework to explain that at all. I think they were just being their private selves. And my argument in the book is that when they walked on stage, or when they walked in front of a camera, they were really doing the same thing that they had done all their lives. They grew up in this tenement apartment, packed with relatives and with various visitors. There were many, many people running around, coming in and out. After that, they were on the vaudeville circuit for 15-plus years, which is a very sort of wounding way of living, and gives you the experience of seeing society from the bottom up, like gamblers, outlaws, and prostitutes, all of whom they consorted with throughout their young years, throughout their childhood and adolescence. And so by the time they emerged before the cameras onto the silver screen, which was what made them famous, these guys were just used to what we think is anarchic, was really the way they had always lived their lives. And that's what's uncanny about them.
Going back to the beginning, what about Groucho's upbringing, both in the Upper East Side and as a middle child, had an effect on his comedy and the way he saw the world?
Right. Well, it's called the Upper East Side now. It was called Yorkville then. And what was unique about it in terms of being the child of Jewish immigrants was that it had a very small Jewish immigrant population. There were Germans and Poles and Irish and a lot of Cubans who had makeshift cigar factories in their apartments. Groucho would have walked around and seen cigar factories in these tenement apartments, partly because of the melange of languages that were spoken in this neighborhood, partly because of his own upbringing. His father spoke French, his mother spoke German. This polyglot sense gave them, also instilled in them, the feeling that language was completely arbitrary. And I think that had the most consequential effect on Groucho.
On Groucho in particular.
Verbal of the brothers, yeah.
What about being Jewish? You say they weren't necessarily in a Jewish area.
Right. They were never that Jewishly identified. They never refer to it in their films. Actually, they do refer to it just once in Coconuts, very fleetingly. They deliberately tried not to be too Jewish because at the time, the Jewish moguls who ran the Hollywood studios were out to create ideal images of WASP America. But they also wanted to have a broader appeal. So there's nothing deliberately or consciously Jewish about them. But, of course, the humor is very Jewish. It's wry, it's ironic, it's dissenting, it's undercutting. It's all those things. So while they were not Jewishly identified, the humor is certainly culturally Jewish.
Sure, and that has a long history going back to the shtetls.
Well, going back to the Bible. You know, I mean, there's an undermining, there's almost an instinctive undermining irony in Jewish humor, the Book of Jonah, right? It's a satire on the other prophetic books. I can't think of the sacred literature of another religion, the sacred scripture of another religion that has incorporates a satire on the rest of the sacred literature. Heine, the great German Jewish poet, would create these structures of ideal sentiments, and then he'd pull the rug out from underneath them. So that's a Jewish reflex. And, of course, the Marx brothers had that in abundance.
And what's built into that? I mean, sort of a defensiveness of an oppressed people?
Yeah, well, you have this group of people who've been banished for millennia to the outskirts of civilization and who felt their own gifts, verbal and intellectual. And as they became more marginalized, their intellectual gifts became more acute. Their analytical and rational powers became more acute. Yet their status in the world continued to be weak or marginal. So this is a perfect breeding ground for humor, which seeks to gain for itself a personal power that is not available in the social world.
All right, so going back to Groucho's childhood, I mean, he had aspirations to be a doctor, and it was his mother that pushed him and his brothers into show business, and he was given opportunities by his uncle, who was a vaudevillian by the name of Al Sheen. But you sort of carry this thread of Groucho's desire to have been a doctor, you know, throughout his life, having an effect on his psyche.
Yeah, well, there was that. But in a more general sense, he wanted to have more of a formal education.
Sure.
than he was allowed to have. And he wanted to be a literary man. That's what was most important to him. And when Mencken included him in his dictionary of American life, Groucho was over the moon. He said he never felt so honored by anything else. I think this feeling that he'd been robbed of a formal education that he felt because of his intellect he deserved, I think that was behind a lot of his verbal pyrotechnics and his destructive attitude towards language and rationality.
One thing that kind of struck me about that is, you know, sort of the inverse of the modern American Jewish tradition, should I say, in that, you know, a Jewish parent now would not necessarily be thrilled about their kid trying to enter show business. They might be pushing them to get a more formal education or to become a doctor. Now, was that the case back then? Was this an anomaly, or was this typical?
Well, the Jewish mothers pushing their kids to become doctors is a little
stereotypical.
Passé. No, sure. I mean, I think that a lot of Jewish mothers, I know some Jewish mothers who are grooming their kids from elementary school to be powerful agents.
Right.
You know, I at the time. No, there was nothing uncharacteristic about it. The mother, not as Jewish mother, as mother, wanted the kids to succeed as best they could, and she felt that show business, because of her connection to her brother Al Sheen, and because of what she felt were the kids' innate talents. I mean, Chico and Harpo taught themselves the piano and the harp, respectively, right? I mean, that's a very formidable natural gift. And I think the mother, whose parents were vaudevillians, had been vaudevillians in Europe, I think the mother saw a kind of genetic predisposition toward being performers and thought that was where they could best succeed. She needed the money, too.
Right.
She wanted the kids to go out and make money.
Which I guess eventually came, but they spent a long time on the vaudeville circuit, beginning as a singing group, but they didn't really get their payday until they started being in the movies, correct? Or on Broadway right before they were in the movies.
Yeah, they were making money in vaudeville, too, but they didn't really break through until they were in their 40s. So
right.
They spent a long, long time sort of, as I said before, looking at society from the bottom up, and that shaped them.
And you also mentioned earlier how Groucho wanted to be taken seriously as a writer. He had designs to become a serious writer. And in your book, you use his contentious correspondence with T.S. Eliot. Why did you use this as a lens into Groucho's mind?
Well, again, the correspondence has always been treated, and certainly by the previous biographers, as this sort of cuddly, endearing exchange of letters between two unlikely correspondents. And I didn't see that. I saw this sort of passive-aggressive hostility going back and forth between the two of them. And I thought that was very much in line with Groucho's personality. No, he doesn't like Eliot. He feels intimidated by Eliot. And so he did what he always did when he felt intimidated by someone's social status or intellectual status. He tries to undermine them. And in the case of Eliot, Groucho's and the Marx Brothers, two weapons of undermining were sex and social origins. He reminds Eliot that he's an older man and no longer sexually potent, and reminds him of his origins in the American Midwestern middle class. And he does this throughout the correspondence, and it's remarkable. So it's very astringent, and Eliot responds with the kind of feline Bloomsbury passive aggression himself, which clearly just drives Groucho up a wall, and it's fascinating.
And when I'm reading this correspondence, I'm just hearing all of it in Groucho's voice. You know, it's hard not to picture Groucho just, you know, with that really rapid-fire sort of turn-of-phrase subversion, as you call it. Did Groucho talk that way off-screen? Did he talk that way when he was at parties? Did he talk that way to his brothers?
To everybody, to actresses. Maureen O'Hara, the actress whom he tried to seduce, said that his rapid patter would melt your face. He was like that with everyone, drove almost all of his wives to drink, to alcoholism. He humiliated his teenage daughter when she came on to You Bet Your Life, his quiz show in the 60s. He was a piece of work. He was hardly a cuddly, snuggly figure of heroic insolence toward authority.
Sure.
You know, the point I try to make is that there's a great line in Night at the Opera when somebody's slapping around Harpo, and Groucho comes up and says, "Hey, you big bully, what's the idea of slapping around this little bully?" And in many ways, the Marx brothers were little bullies, fashioned in the image of big bullies. You know, their father was this weak, ineffectual tailor,
right,
who also had a puffed-up conception of himself. And the result was that the brothers grew up with a kind of natural contempt for the powerful, but also a natural contempt for the powerless. And I think that's the real dark tension that never gets talked about with them.
Sure. And you just mentioned that he drove all of his wives to drink, and his wives were pretty young, and, you know, I've seen Groucho's daughter say that she believed that he did not respect women. I want to play a clip from Duck Soup, and you mentioned this in your book as well as sort of a lens into Groucho's misogyny.
As chairwoman of the reception committee, I extend the good wishes of every man, woman, and child of Fredonia.
Never mind that stuff. Take a card.
Card? What'll I do with the card?
You can keep it. I've got 51 left. Now, what were you saying?
I've sponsored your appointment because I feel you are the most able statesman in all Fredonia.
Well, that covers a lot of ground. Say, you cover a lot of ground yourself. You better beat it. I hear they're going to tear you down and put up an office building where you're standing. You can leave in a taxi. If you can't get a taxi, you can leave in a huff. If that's too soon, you can leave in a minute and a huff. You know you haven't stopped talking since I came here? You must have been vaccinated with a phonograph needle.
The future of Fredonia rests on you. Promise me you'll follow in the footsteps of my husband.
Not that I care, but where is your husband?
Why, he's dead.
I'll bet he's just using that as an excuse.
I was with him till the very end.
No wonder he passed away.
I held him in my arms and kissed him.
Oh, I see. Then it was murder. Will you marry me? Did he leave you any money? Answer the second question first.
So that's from the 1933 Marx Brothers movie Duck Soup. We heard Margaret Dumont playing Mrs. Teasdale, who had just nominated Rufus T. Firefly, played by Groucho Marx, to lead the fictitious nation of Fredonia. Now, they made fun of everybody. Why do you think, based on this clip, that it was misogyny as opposed to just a general contempt for everyone?
Well, I don't base my interpretation of his misogyny just on this clip.
No, certainly not, but you did pull it out.
Yeah. At the end of Horse Feathers, the three brothers jump on a young woman. It's kind of a gang rape. It's unbearable to watch. Could probably never even find its way into a movie now. You look at his constant attacks on Margaret Dumont, and you know, at first you think, well, she deserves it because she's pompous and this and that. But then you watch the movies again, and she's actually quite kind.
Right.
She's clueless. She's kind of got this sort of self-congratulatory air of the cluelessly wealthy who live on an insulated cloud. But why does she deserve that kind of abuse?
Right. She nominated him to be the president.
Right. Any club that had me as a member. The abuse takes the form of attacks on her femininity. You cover a lot of ground. You kissed your husband. This is a misogyny that I find unpleasant, that is what became the stock and trade of the Jewish comedian of that era, and not a few Jewish mid-20th century novelists. And when I come across it now, I find it very distasteful.
Do you find it funny?
Yes, absolutely. Some of it is funny. Some of that patter that you just played is funny. Some of it's not funny at all, like the scene with the at the young woman at the end of Horse Feathers. And some of that routine that you just played is not, I don't find funny. The take my wife, please.
Henny Youngman.
Henny Young. You're right. That was the war cry of the Jewish comic. And no, I don't find that funny.
It also had the same sort of economy of words that Groucho had. It's what, a 5-word joke? Am I counting that wrong? Take my wife.
Yeah,
four
I don't
words.
Know if right. I don't know if Groucho's had an economy of words. He was certainly barbed. The finest moment to me, the funniest moment with Margaret Dumont is at the beginning of Animal Crackers, when he comes back and he plays Captain Spaulding, the great African explorer, who of course is a fraud, like all the great figures he plays. And she's a socialite, a wealthy socialite, and she's hosting him at her mansion, a celebration of his heroism. And he arrives and she says to him,
Captain Spaulding, you stand before me as one of the bravest men of all time.
All right, I'll do that.
And I love that, because that's not an attack on her as a woman, or even as a person. That's a puncturing of inflated ideas of heroism that just reflect back on the inflator. And also standing the word stand on its head. He's doing all kinds of stuff. That I love, certainly.
Is there any indication that Margaret Dumont did not like this sort of ongoing derision? I mean, they were in several movies together. Did she handle it well, or was she kind of upset by it?
Yeah, well, the sort of stock notion of her that's come down was that she didn't even understand what they were saying.
Right.
She didn't get it. Well, that's not true. Of course she got it. She
right.
was smart. She was an accomplished stage actress. Emotionally, her husband, whom she loved very much, had just died before she fell in with the Marx Brothers. She was kind of numb. She was kind of traumatized throughout these. But she certainly got the jokes, and she laughed at them, and they all got along well. And there's no real evidence that she didn't understand what was going on and that she didn't enjoy it.
We'll get back to Radio Times producer John Aaron's interview with Lee Siegel about his book, Groucho Marx, The Comedy of Existence, after this very short break. Stay with us. I'm Marty Moscoen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. And we're also listening to Radio Times producer John Aaron's interview with Lee Siegel about Groucho Marx. Siegel writes about culture and politics for The New York Times and for The Wall Street Journal. His new book is titled Groucho Marx, The Comedy of Existence.
We need to move on to one of Groucho's most enduring, and, you know, this is sort of his legacy. This is Groucho tied up into one quote. I do not want to belong to any club that will accept me as a member. Why is this Groucho? How is this just Groucho in one quote?
Well, it's not. The quote's been grossly misunderstood for a long time, mostly due to Woody Allen, who used it in
Annie Hall.
Allen turned it into the epitome of Jewish self-loathing. You wouldn't want to belong to a club that would have you as a member because you hate yourself, blah, blah, blah. Well, no, that's not what happened. This was a real club that he'd been inducted into.
Was it the Friars Club?
I'm not sure if it was the Friars. There are different names for the club. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure exactly what it was called. Let's say it was the Friars Club. It's out in California. He shows up at this club expecting all these sort of illustrious figures to be there whom he can talk about literature with. That's what a private club meant to him. Instead, he sees a bunch of guys sitting around, as he describes it, gambling, drinking, smoking, and on the phone with other members' wives, philandering. It was just like the apartment he grew up in, which is what they did. His father was a great philanderer. So he shows up at this club. It should be the mark of his social ascent and actually reminds him of the origins that it took him so long to escape from. Then he says he tried to strike up a conversation with somebody at the club, someone Groucho describes as being a barber. It's unlikely that this guy was a barber. But the first thing he says to Groucho is that he talks about the poor quality of the recent inductees. So he insults Groucho.
Right.
Now, nobody could insult Groucho and get away with it. This guy had a very fragile ego. This guy caught gonorrhea from a prostitute when he was 15 years old, which became inflamed throughout his life and kept coming back. That's probably why he called the second volume of his autobiography Memoirs of a Mangy Lover. He never forgot that. He was obsessed with the gonorrhea that he'd contracted. So here's this guy insulting him. And Groucho tries to talk about Chaucer or something with the guy, and the guy refuses to engage him. And Groucho goes home and writes what is known as the famous resignation letter.
Right.
So it's not because he hates himself. It's because he feels superior to these guys and doesn't want to have anything to do with them. And he affects this kind of British aristocratic self-deprecation. But that's not at all what he means. He means, you're not good enough for me and I don't want to belong to this club. But he expresses himself in a kind of, you know, in a characteristically self-undermining, ironic way. But it's really just a way, as it is for an aristocrat, to just aggrandize himself and display his superiority.
Now, one club that they were a part of by nature of being in the business, and one thing that you argue they are against, is comedy itself. Can you elaborate on their attempts to undermine even the nature of comedy?
Yeah. They knew they weren't being funny at times. Groucho knew that he, on screen and on stage, sometimes he would just insult people. There was nothing funny about it. They resented the constraints put on them by the studios, by the various scriptwriters, the studios hired by the directors, and they didn't like the very conventions of comedy itself. They built on the convention of humor, but they tried to undermine it, and sometimes by explicitly not being funny at all, just being purely abusive and insulting.
Now, it's hard to imagine Chico, Harpo, and Groucho sitting around a table and discussing, you know, the nature of their own comedy. I mean, to what extent do you think that they did that they analyzed themselves, and or was it just incidental that they were just reacting to their environment?
These guys were beyond analysis. They couldn't be analyzed, and I don't think they ever sought to analyze themselves or to think of humor in analytic terms. They would be horrified by this interview. They would take my book and throw it on the bonfire of books in horse feathers. No, I don't. I think they wanted to make people laugh, or they simply wanted to get people out of their way. But no, I don't think they ever thought analytically about humor.
And they also occupied sort of their own realms in each of their films. As you say, they're sometimes just not on screen together at all. Like, to what extent do you think that they were involved with each other's sensibilities? Like, was Harpo giving notes to Groucho, or were they just sort of in their own corners?
You know, that's one of the mysteries of the Marx Brothers. No one can say to what extent they were involved in their movies. The only thing that's for certain is that they were involved, and they would throw out jokes if they didn't like them. They would improvise. They were very emphatic about what they wanted. There's a famous story about George S. Kaufman, who wrote some of their early movies, one of them being Animal Crackers. And when Animal Crackers was on the stage, or maybe I'm wrong, maybe it's the coconuts. You know, I wrote the book and then immediately had to forget everything I wrote in order to write something
sure.
else. But he was standing in the wings, and Kaufman turns to somebody and says, "Hey, wait a minute, I think I just heard one of my original lines." So they changed everything. I don't think they were that involved in each other's shticks. Mm-hmm. I think each one went his own way. What's interesting about watching them on screen is that they intersect, but they never interact. And even when they seem to be interacting, they're like, there was a book written once called The Three Christs of Ypsilanti. This was in the golden age of sociology, right, in the 1950s. And it was a study of three psychotics, each of whom thought he was Christ, in an insane asylum in Ypsilanti, Michigan. And that's what the Marx Brothers are. They're the three Christs of Ypsilanti. They're like three psychotics who are simply not aware of each other's existence. And I just don't think that they had much to do with each other's routines.
I am producer John Ahrens. I'm speaking with Lee Siegel, who's just published a book called Groucho Marx, The Comedy of Existence. He is the author of five books, and he writes about culture and politics for the New York Times and Wall Street Journal, among other things. Earlier in the interview, you mentioned that they weren't necessarily just against the wealthy or the pompous, that they were against everything, or at least Groucho himself was. And, you know, I went through a bunch of the archives of You Bet Your Life, a show that Groucho hosted, a quiz show, in which he would sort of engage in patter with more ordinary people, not necessarily the wealthy elite. And I couldn't really find any examples of him being explicitly mean to them. I want to play one clip from You Bet Your Life that aired in the 50s.
Norma, outside of raising eggs at a dollar a dozen, do you do anything else? Do you ever get away from the ranch?
I dabble in the PTA.
What do you mean you dabble in it?
Oh, I'm on committees and I make speeches and tell stories, that sort of thing.
But you tell stories, you say? Could you tell us one now?
Well, I don't do it very well. I'd rather
not. Oh, come on. You must be able to remember one story.
Yeah, I remember one.
Yeah, you see? She's laughing already, huh?
Oh, this is a real cute story. It's about two men who met...
Well, that's always a good beginning, huh?
They met at this bus stop.
It's more exciting if there's one man and one woman.
They met at the bus stop every morning and got on the bus to ride to work, but they never spoke. Every morning...
Well, why should they speak if they don't know each other?
Every morning, Don... Every morning...
This must kill him at the PTA.
Again, that's from the quiz show You Bet Your Life, which was hosted by Groucho Marx. Yeah, a lot of the clips that I saw, he wasn't being derisive towards these people. He was poking fun at them, but it seemed like he was warm to them. Am I mistaken in that?
I don't think there was anything warm about Groucho. Of course he wasn't mean, but they all became his foils, as that woman did. The audience is laughing with her, but the audience is laughing at her as well. And, Colbert's whole persona comes out of that in his old show. And still, the undermining of the guests and having, speaking at a skeptical angle to them and sending them up and using them as foils. The genius of You Bet Your Life was that he did that with shopkeepers and five-star generals. He had generals on the show, right, whom he was poking, whom he used as foils. And it was very liberating. And I think that more than anything else established his iconicity, as it were, his status as an icon.
Do you think Groucho found himself funny?
That's a good question. He certainly had a very, either healthy or diseased idea of his own limitations. Well, you have to have a strong ego to keep going in that line of work, and so I'm sure that on some level he did think that he was very funny indeed. But he wasn't a conventional egotist. His egotism lay in his power to explode his ego and then expect you to do the same. I don't think he would have kept going as a comedian all those decades if he didn't think he was funny.
Sure. Did he hate himself?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't. Self-hatred in its purest form is self-annihilating, and you just don't advance in life.
Right.
Groucho had a wonderfully successful, triumphant life. So if he hated himself, he had a handle on it. Let's put it like that.
He hated himself well, yeah.
He hated himself as part of his self-love. I think the self-hatred gave him a kind of extra boost that other people didn't have.
Now, as he got older, he would make appearances on television. He would go on the Dick Cavett Show, and he certainly had lost his speed, should I say. He had slowed down, at least verbally and maybe mentally, but... I want to play a clip of his appearance on William F. Buckley's show, The Firing Line. And something that's funny to me about this clip is that the setup, we'll hear from the moderator of this debate, which the question is the world funny? The moderator of this debate sets up this clip, and he almost basically sounds like a version of Margaret Dumont.
My name is C. Dickerman Williams, and I shall act as chairman of this discussion between Mr. Marx and Mr. Buckley. The subject of the discussion will be, is the world funny? Mr. Marx, would you answer Mr. Buckley's question, is the world funny?
He didn't ask me, you just asked me.
Would you answer my question?
No, I don't think it's terribly funny, I don't think it's ever terribly funny. Sometimes there are isolated pieces of the world that is funny, but generally it's a pretty serious world, it always has been. It's people struggling for a living and starving and all kinds of riots, and particularly a couple of weeks ago. No, I don't think the world is funny. It's like saying, is a man funny? Even a professional comedian can be funny perhaps 8 minutes out of about 24 hours. But a comedian isn't. They're the dreariest people in the world. You should talk to my wife sometime. which is more than I do.
Is that an invitation?
There's so much of the Groucho that you talk about in your book embedded in that clip. There's the misogyny, there's self-effacing, saying he's only funny, you know, 8 minutes out of the day, that he's a miserable person. Do you think that they booked him on that show thinking that he was going to be funny, or that he was going to express that the world is actually a funny place?
I don't know, but that show is really one of the great wonders of American culture. But if you watch that, the whole interview is available. It's extraordinary because Groucho doesn't like him. The two men don't like each other from the get-go.
He calls him young girl at one point.
And he does what he always does when he feels that somebody's trying to lord it over him. He uses sex to undermine that person. He tells Buckley that he smiles like a young girl, and tells him he'd look good in a green bikini or something like that. But maybe, you know, Buckley was somewhat effeminate. Maybe Groucho was zeroing in on that. It's very, very much of its moment, right? I don't think saying that somebody smells like a young girl would be an insult now.
Right.
But you know, it's very much part of his mindset. But he doesn't like Buckley. And what's very interesting is they have an exchange about civil rights. I think Groucho deliberately brought in civil rights because Buckley was not a big advocate of that.
To say the least.
And they start talking about minstrelsy, and they use the word that was used at the time. This is in the early 60s, Negro. Buckley says that he doesn't see anything wrong with the convention of blackface.
Right.
And Groucho obviously finds this very distasteful. And he says, well, I think it's okay when Negro performers do it, but not when white performers do it. And that is one positive aspect of him. And I talk about that in the book. The movie Day at the Races, which a previous biographer, Stephen Kampfer, has written the definitive biography of Groucho. But unfortunately, it's marred by a lot of kind of made-up stuff. And he says that Day at the Races is a strong instance of Hollywood racism. Nothing could be further from the truth. It really is the whole movie is a pun on the word races. The real title should be A Day of the Races, because in that movie, white people are associated with a white sanitarium for rich, white, mentally exhausted people. All the corrupt people in it are white, corrupt businessmen abetted by a corrupt sheriff, and the heroes are black. The poor black people who live in this shantytown, they're the heroes. They dance with intellectual rigor and joy and self-discipline, and at the end, the brothers put on blackface. Not a repetition of this problematic vaudeville convention, but strictly, the only note that struck is a note of solidarity with blacks. And all his life, he felt very strongly about civil rights. Groucho, and he never forgot what it was like to be on this harsh, wounding vaudeville circuit, looking at society from the bottom up with black people and other people who've been exiled to the margins of society. And it's all there in the interview with Buckley.
I've been talking with Lee Siegel. He's the author of Groucho Marx, The Comedy of Existence. He is a cultural critic, author of 5 books, and writes about culture and politics for The New York Times and The Wall Street Journal. Lee Siegel, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
It's been great to be here.
I don't know what they have to say. It makes no difference anyway. Whatever it is, I'm against it. No matter what it is or who commenced it, I'm against it. Your proposition may be good, but let's have one thing understood. Whatever it is, I'm against it. And even when you've changed it or condensed it, I'm against it. I'm opposed to it. On general principles, I'm opposed to it.
He's opposed to it. In fact, indeed, that he's opposed to it.
For months before my son was born, I used to yell from night till morn, whatever it is, I'm against it. And I've kept yelling since I first commenced it. I'm against it.
That was Radio Times producer John Ahrens talking with Lee Siegel about his book, Groucho Marx, The Comedy of Existence. Siegel is the author of 5 books and writes about culture and politics for The New York Times and for The Wall Street Journal. We posted that clip from Groucho's appearance on Bill Buckley's Firing Line, and you can check it out on our Facebook page. Also, tell us what you think of the show. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by our intern is Abby Sarfo. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks for joining us.